Recording now. And I'll be managing the panelists, and I allowed, as far as I know, most people to get involved, but I'll be controlling the flow as much as I can. For basically some security reasons, we can't have this an open discussion. Welcome to the Religion and Practice Conversation series on religious situation in Ukraine. And obviously we will have a lot of questions. What are the religious dimensions of an ongoing Russian invasion of Ukraine? What are the global religious theological responses to this? And in this episode of our podcast, I'm thrilled to host an sociologist, Professor Jose Casanova, to address some of these questions and other questions. For a man who doesn't need an introduction, but I have to do it still, Jose Casanova is one of the world's top scholars in sociology of religion, and a senior fellow at Berkeley Center, where his work focuses on globalization, religions, and secularization. He's also professor emeritus at Georgetown University, where he previously taught in the Department of Sociology and Department of Theology and Religious Studies. He has published works on a broad range of subjects, including religion and globalization, migration and religious pluralism, transnational religions, and sociological theory. His best-known work, Public Religions in Modern World, University of Chicago Press, has become a modern classic in the field and has been translated into numerous languages, including Japanese, Arabic, and Turkish. And in 2012, Professor Casanova was awarded the Theology Prize from Salzburg Hochschulwochen in the recognition of his lifelong achievements in the field of theology. Quickly, rules. Professor Casanova will open the floor. We have a few questions on my behalf, and we'll have the panelists and colleagues to join in. So Professor Casanova, floor is yours. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Professor Metrivelli, for again inviting me to Lund virtually. It's a great pleasure to have the opportunity to have this conversation. Unfortunately, the circumstances are not happy ones, but I think that we need to discuss the religious dimension of this conflict, which are many, many, many varied. Let me start. Actually, what I'm going to do is start with a few news. Today's news from the Religious Information Service of Ukraine is the best source on religion in Ukraine. You can go there daily and you will find news on all religious organizations of Ukraine and everything having to do with religion in the region. So let me just go through just a few of them. Again, if you are interested, the website is RISU, R-I-S-U, .ua, Ukraine. Let me see. Again, they appear in Ukrainian first, but most of them you are able to translate immediately into English. They also have translated. The first one, priests of four different denominations pray in Santa Sofia. Svyata Sofia is, of course, the great shrine of Kiev Rus of the 11th century, and four priests that happen to be Archpriest Georgi Kovalenko from the Orthodox Church of Ukraine in communion with the Ecumenical Patriarch, Father Thomas Kuska from the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, Father Peter Balok from the Roman Catholic Church, and Pastor Fedir Raichenets from the World Councils of Churches, obviously a Protestant minister. So here you have representatives of the three major Christianities, Roman, Eastern, and Reform Christianity, praying together in Saint Sophia. You go to the next news, and basically is already 44, at least 44 temples, mosque, synagogue, house of prayers have already been destroyed at the war. Most of them happen to be actually churches of the Exarchate of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church in communion with the Moscow Patriarchate. So actually, the Russian forces, military, who are supposed to come there to protect Rus and to protect the Orthodox Church, because they claim that usually is being repressed by Ukrainians and by the Ukrainian government. It happens to be that the most of the destruction of temples had been upon the church, because most of the churches in the eastern regions in the south are predominantly Moscow Patriarchate. We could go on to the news that basically religious communities in Lviv have already taken care of over 60,000 refugees. This is, and again, a fourth news, a bishop of the Life of the World Church in Melitopol has been kidnapped along with the mayor, along with the police chief of the town and a few of the council members. And then basically another news of how half of the religious communities in Crimea have disappeared since the annexation in 2014. And many, many of them are, of course, belonging to the Ukraine Orthodox Church that is not Moscow Patriarchate, and to the Greek Catholic Church. These news together are two interesting things. One is the kind of interreligious dialogue, the kind of harmonious living together of all the religious communities and organizations in Ukraine. There is AUCRO, the All Ukrainian Council of Churches and Religious Organizations, that gathers all the churches, all the Christian churches, the three main Eastern churches in Ukraine, two Orthodox and the Greek Catholic Church and the Roman Catholics, and many, many Protestant groups, Baptists, Pentecostals, Lutherans, Methodists, etc. I mean, Mormons, Jehovah's Witness, and then also Muslim and Jewish organizations. All of them, if you go back to the news in around the 24th of August, when Ukraine was celebrating the 30th anniversary of its independence and got an official visit from the Ecumenical Patriarch, there was a picture of the Ecumenical Patriarch, Patriarch Bartholomew, surrounded by about 30 leaders of 30 religious organizations in Ukraine. The only absent was the Ukraine Orthodox Church, Moscow Patriarchate, is the only one that claims to have ownership, the canonical territory over all of Ukraine, and therefore does not welcome other Christian churches on its territory. They are called, the Greek Catholic Church are called Uniates, which is the worst possible heresy you could have, and the other Orthodox are called schismatics, and the Protestants are called heretics. And this is the way in which they are labeled. And as we see from what happened in Luhansk and Donetsk and what happened in Crimea, those are the first victims of the reoccupation of these territories by the Russian military and the Moscow Patriarchate coming behind them. So this is, I want to point out this kind of dual story, the story of very successful, very pluralist religious diversity in Ukraine, and the opposite, which is the ideology of the Ruski Mir, namely the idea that all the Russians of Rus, of historical Rus of the 11th century, are one single territory, one single nation, namely the Belarusians, the Ukrainians, and the Russians, one single church, the Moscow Patriarchate, and one single Tsar Putin. And it is in the base of this ideology, which later we can go into the political dimensions, the theological dimensions of this ideology, but it is what has been used to legitimate this war, which happens to be practically a war of extermination of the Ukrainian people, of the cities. So you have this paradox of a war in the name of reuniting the Ruski people, and yet what is happening is a destruction of Ukrainian population. As you know, 3.5 million of refugees, I mean, out of Ukraine, about 10 million displaced within Ukraine. Basically one of every fourth Ukrainian now already lives outside of their homes. So this is the situation now. After this introduction, I'll be glad to basically address your questions, Tornike.
So the very important part here, thank you very much, Jose, is of course the sort of the political context. And also you mentioned the idea of Russian world or the project. Of course, it's a kind of a hybrid. It's a hybrid of ideology or geopolitical project, but it has some sort of a theological rhetoric. And if we look at Putin's announcement of the war, or his council, or first his recognition of Donbas and Luhansk republics, he referred to Orthodox faith, and he's having these references more and more, especially his last Moscow, or whether it was staged or not, but his last appearance in which he spoke a few days ago referred to New Testament. And what sort of curve now does Russia have in a way? What kind of theological, religious underpinnings of this war we have? Can we make theological sense of it in a way?
Well, there are two dimensions to the Ruski Mir concept. One is, you could say, basically imperial. And before, when Putin began to use it, the Ruski Mir simply meant the Russian speakers abroad, namely the world of wherever Russian language is spoken belongs to the Russian world, and a claim that therefore we have a right to intervene in those territories to protect our Russian compatriots. The claim being that anybody who speaks Russian is therefore belongs to Russia, as if Irish people would belong to the United Kingdom because they speak English. We know, of course, that this is not the case. Or, I mean, Spanish, Latin Americans, they belong to Spain because they speak Spanish. So basically it's a colonial imperial idea. And it had no religious dimension at first, because Putin was not interested in religious ideology. His first presidency was based on Eurasian ideology. But then in his second presidency, after 2010, there it comes when the Moscow Patriarchate added the theological dimension to Ruski Mir. Ruski Mir being the lands of Kiev and Rus. And as today, one of his statements, basically he actually said, the Russian Orthodox Church must defend God's truth that we are truly one people who came out of the Kiev baptismal font. Namely, we all came out of Kiev and Rus, we are one people, and therefore the Moscow Patriarchate is the only church that has canonicity in this territory, and there can be no other form of Christianity. Now, you remember in 2014, the annexation of Crimea, that first they said they did not invade, then later when actually he acknowledged that they had occupied Crimea, he said, Crimea is ours because Prince Volodymyr was baptized in Kherson. Now, if Crimea is Russian because Prince Volodymyr was baptized there, even more so Kiev is Russian because obviously Kiev and Rus and Prince Volodymyr of Kiev. So therefore, this is the fundamental mythological idea of the myth of Russian origins, which of course then denies the existence to the Ukrainians, and thus the need to say that Ukraine is an invention in the 19th century, when Imperial Russia also denied basically identity and agency to Ukrainians. They said Ukraine is an invention of the Poles. They're actually Malorosse, Little Russians. This was the official name of Ukraine. Malorossia, it was Little Russia, was the official name of Ukraine, Imperial Russia. And Putin has many, many times said that this is a phony country, does not exist. The Ukrainians, this is an invention either of Lenin or of Stalin or now of the US. So anyhow, it's always somebody else that has brainwashed our Little Russian Ukrainians. Without the external evil forces, we will be united as brothers. And so you have here the contradiction of a claim that these are our brothers and we come to liberate them. But of course, because they are not really themselves, they've been brainwashed and they're in the hands of Nazi rulers. So you have a Jewish president of Ukraine that is called a Nazi, right? And you have always the notion that all Ukrainians are fascist or Banderiuchi, followers of Bandera. So you need to have this ideology in order to legitimate killing them if they don't want to become Russians. So you have this contradiction, therefore. And so it's not as simple, if you wish, military war to defeat the enemy. It becomes then a war of extermination, a Vernichtungskrieg in the Nazi sense of the term. You need to exterminate them precisely if they don't want to be who they are supposed to be, namely Russians. And so, of course, they were hoping that because there are indeed half of the population of Ukraine are Russian speakers. But of course, the idea that because somebody speaks Russian is therefore a Russian, of course, in language, in Russian, you distinguish between Ruski and Rosen. I mean, Russia is not Rus. The Rosyansky, the language, you distinguish between Russian and Ruski. And but in Russian, you only have one name. I remember the first time I visited Kiev, it was in 89. I was bringing the democracy seminar from the new School of Social Research to join Ukraine's interest in democratization together with dissident movements in Poland, Adam Michnik and Kuron, and in the Czech Republic, Havel and others, and in Hungary, Janusz Kis and others. And I remember the first time I met a group of people, half of them spoke only Russian. I did not understand Russian. So they had, for the first time in their lives, tried to speak Russian with me, but then I understood that to speak Russian doesn't mean to be Russian. They were truly patriots, Ukrainian patriots, fighting or at least struggling to develop an independent democratic Ukraine. And so I realized that you cannot identify language, Ukrainian language, therefore with Ukrainian nation or Russian language with Russian nation. This is Ukraine is a civic nation, a political nation made up of Russian and Ukrainian speakers and of many, many religions. So it's a multilingual, a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, if you wish, demos, which cannot be identified with the ethnic Ukrainian nation. It's an open, tolerant, democratic society, which is very pluralistic, linguistically, ethnically, and religiously.
And an important part here is the role of Orthodox Christianity. And I wonder, what do you think was the Orthodox Christianity instrumentalized in this military conflict? Or did it actually serve a more foundational role, sort of laying the basic foundations for this invasion?
Well, here the background is the big conflict, or even if you wish, competition between the Ecumenical Patriarch, which is considered to be the Ecumenical Patriarch, the primus inter pares of all Orthodox churches, of Orthodox Christianity, and the attempt of the Moscow Patriarchate in the last 10 years, claiming to be the largest Orthodox church in the world, and therefore claiming to be, if you wish, the third Rome. This is part of the argument of Russian Orthodoxy since the 16th century, after the fall of Byzantium, the second Rome. If you wish, the primacy of Orthodox Christianity has passed to Moscow, which is the Third Rome. And this idea came already to a head in the preparation of the famous General Synod of all Orthodoxy, the Holy and General Synod of Orthodoxy, that had been in preparation for 40, 50 years, and finally was going to meet in Crete in 2016. But then at the last moment, the Russian Orthodox Church, together with a few other churches, basically boycotted the meeting precisely because the issue of autocephaly, for the Ukrainian Orthodox Church was supposed to be discussed there. And Russians then began into a conflict with the Moscow, with the Ecumenical Patriarch. And this out of this conflict came then when the Ecumenical Patriarch announced that he was going to basically give the tomos of autocephaly to the fusion of the several Ukrainian Orthodox churches that were not in communion with global Orthodoxy. Immediately the next day, Putin called the Security Council of the Russian Federation because this was for them almost a declaration of war against Russia. And you could say that this was the moment, this was in 2018, right before the tomos, you could say that this was the moment in which they decided that they had to intervene to make sure that they wouldn't lose Ukraine.
I wonder.
We can go back to 2014 also, and we may. But let's go on to other questions, please.
And again, going back to a few chain of events, Ukraine's colored revolutions, annexation of Crimea, war in Donbas. How were those chain of events perceived and explained by the Russian and the Ukrainian churches ethically or theologically or socially? I mean, today we're seeing a really major event. Last night, and this morning, I was listening to the Puchayev Lavra's commemoration service. It was 11 hours of prayer, and for the first time, they didn't commemorate Kirill. Actually, for Puchayev Lavra standards of, and for those who don't follow the Orthodox world, I mean, this is one of the backbones of the Russian world ideology, and some of the most conservative clerics are in this Lavra in the Western Ukraine, and it has always been the kind of the foundational for the Russian conservatives. So basically, there are some transformations there. Many people say that, well, people are switching, and this switches from the Moscow Patriarchate to the newly created church will create divisions. And this is kind of the end of the Russian world idea as we know it. And there is no way out of this for the Russian Orthodox Church. And more priests and bishops distanced. There was today again news that an entire monastery in Lviv moved to the new, moved out of the Moscow Patriarchate's domain. And this interconfessional changes are a major thing for, and also that's the kind of the influence of the commemoration practice, that is seemingly the end of it as we know it. How do you think, what will be considering again the church's importance in this countries, what kind of maybe dynamics shall we expect here?
Well, we must understand that in 1987, when Glasnost arrived in Ukraine, and it arrived relatively late. Glasnost in Russia had already started in 1981. 87, because of the position of the Communist Party in Soviet Ukraine, immediately, well, at the time, the only official church in Ukraine was the Moscow Patriarchate. So there was no, there were a few Roman Catholic churches, but otherwise there were no Protestant churches. Below, they were underground, no Orthodox churches outside of the Moscow Patriarchate, and no Greek Catholic churches. They had been basically repressed, eliminated as churches. The leadership was taken to the Gulag. But then 87 came, and you had the beginning of people, especially beginning in Lviv Oblast, leaving the Moscow Patriarchate and going back to either the old Greek Catholic Church or to the new two Orthodox churches that became now competing with the Moscow Patriarchate. The KU Patriarchate under Filaret, who had been the head of the Russian Orthodox Church in Ukraine, and the historical autocephalous church that had emerged first during the Bolshevik Revolution, and then again during World War II. So whenever there was a chance, Ukrainian Orthodox decided or wanted to have their own autocephalous autonomous church. Head from Moscow or away from Moscow was the kind of the calling all the time. It is in this context, then of course, then you have people actually taken over their church buildings because they were the parishioners. And then of course, Moscow Patriarchate arguing, you see the violence against us, the Moscow Patriarchate is being repressed. Now, imagine, I don't know how many, imagine that there were 7,000 Moscow Patriarchate churches in Ukraine at the time. Today there are over 14,000. So you could say, and there are roughly 7,000 of the new Orthodox Church and about 4,000 Greek Catholics. So these are churches that were before Moscow Patriarchate, and many of them now are either Greek Catholic or Orthodox, new churches they built. But the Moscow Patriarchate, not only every church they lose, they build a new church, not because they have more parishioners, because in terms of faithful, probably they are much smaller than the new Orthodox Church of Ukraine. But in terms of buildings, they have most of the buildings. So part of the ideology is Russian Orthodoxy is repressing Ukraine. Look, every time there is a movement, the parishioners leaving the church and moving to another religious organization, they accuse them of being repressed, of the government repressing and not protecting Russian Orthodoxy, et cetera. Now, I recently delivered the Boschurku lecture on the three let's say, Kievan Churches of Ukraine and the three Roms. And I argued that despite what my Ukrainian friends say, I anticipate that the Russian Orthodox Church will remain in Ukraine as a small but nonetheless viable church. This was, of course, before the war. Today we see how it's become much more difficult for most Ukrainians that were willing to stay within the Moscow Patriarchate to stay now after the war. Now, they would like the Metropolitan Archbishop of Kiev, Onufriu, to be the one leading the movement to declare either an autocephalous church, which of course would only create a new schismatic church, or actually to reunite with the under the ecumenical patriarch, in communion with the ecumenical patriarch, which was of course what was intended at the beginning, but only two bishops from the Moscow Patriarchate actually moved to the new church. Many priests did, many churches did. And now we see a mass movement of parishioners, of churches, as you point, of monasteries. So whatever remains of the Moscow Patriarchate in Ukraine is going to be much more diminished, but they still have some of the most important historical monasteries and buildings in Ukraine, like Pecherska Laura in Kiev, of course, and many others. So the issue will not be resolved probably, but the claim, the state, the Ukrainian state has always said, we are not going to impose, the state is part for the religious communities to work this out. And also the Orthodox Church, until now, they have not tried to force the suppression of the Orthodox Church, Moscow Patriarchate, but there are the possibilities of real conflict having place in Ukraine, although until now, at least on the Ukrainian side, they have really, really restrained themselves to make sure that no violence against Moscow Orthodox churches happens, although they are announcing in Russia that pogroms of Russian Orthodox churches are taking place, or Moscow Patriarchate churches are taking place in Ukraine. As you know, this is part of the false flags, trying to precisely to provoke, so then their provocation becomes then a reality. Let's hope that this not happen.
Thanks very much, Jose. We have now time for questions, if we have questions here, or if not, I have a few questions in the chat. So I'll start from the questions in the chat. First one was about the, what was the position of other churches about the ongoing situation, Catholic Church, and how did they respond? What's the sort of the future between the Orthodox, Russian Orthodoxy and other churches? And second one about the reconciliatory power of churches, because they're so influential. So because of the popularity and the humanitarian efforts, do churches have a chance to bridge the gap between these two societies?
I mean, here, of course, the main question is the role of what remains of the Ukraine Orthodox Church Moscow Patriarchate. Of course, this was originally the idea of the so-called Union of Brest after the Union of Florence was precisely, the Union of Brest is the origin of what we call today the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, was to reunite, of course, Constantinople and Rome. We know that the relations between Rome and Constantinople are very good. There was no contact between the Pope and the Patriarch of Moscow until finally the Pope was willing to go to Havana to meet with Kirill, the only place which Kirill could accept going. And the Pope said to meet with him, the culture of the encounter, anywhere. Today, of course, so it was the Pope that tried to do it. You could say that the Moscow Patriarchate only became interested when they were in conflict with the Ecumenical Patriarch, and they know that the Ecumenical Patriarch and the Pope are very close. So again, to a certain extent, only a post-Kirill, post-Putin Russian Orthodox Church that is not anymore simply allied with Imperial Russia, is there a chance to heal the internal, if you will, religious war within Orthodoxy, because this conflict between the Moscow and the Ecumenical Patriarch is also against the Patriarch of Alexandria and against Orthodoxy in Africa. So now Russian Orthodox Church is trying to establish churches allied to them against the Patriarch of Alexandria, who is supposed to be the head of all the Orthodox churches in Africa. So in this respect, this conflict over Ukraine is spilling over the entire Orthodox world. We've seen recently that about 300 Orthodox theologians signed a petition basically condemning the theology, the heretic Manichaean theology behind this war, arguing that this is simply unchristian, this is not Orthodox theology, the Ruski Mir cannot be taken as a form of Orthodox theology. So in this respect, we hope that within the Russian Orthodox Church, still there are sectors, priests, faithful, that will be willing to have a reconciliation with the rest of global Orthodoxy. So this is, again, it's going to take some time to heal, because everywhere throughout the global Orthodoxy, they have to take sides today, and this is very unfortunate.
Thanks very much, Jose. Another question is the about, again, the quick summary of this is that, is there a division between or within the Russian Orthodox Church that can give us hopes that there'll be a split between the churches, and so that it means that some trend, maybe a liberal trend, will dominate, and that will be kind of the new platform under which this can humanitarian efforts can be realized?
In the same way that we see that there is a very severe repression of anybody who is against the war in Russia, the same, of course, happens even more within the Russian Orthodox Church. That there are people who are not happy with the leadership of Kirill is very clear when, for instance, when there were demonstrations and priests of the Russian Orthodox Church throughout the Russian Federation signed a petition protesting the use of excessive force by the police against peaceful demonstrations. We still hear voices. Recently, Sergei Chapnin, an Orthodox theologian, wrote a very, very powerful critique of the theology behind the war. You have people like Cyril Hovorun, who is a Ukrainian, but still a member of the Moscow Diocese, and who is theologically very much criticizing the what he calls the heretic Manichaean theology behind Ruski Mir. We know that there were people not happy with the direction of the Russian Orthodox Church under Kirill, but they don't have the possibility of expressing this voice. Only in a post-Putin regime, a post-Kirill church, the possibility of these sectors within Russian Orthodoxy can become public and can perhaps renew the Russian Orthodox Church.
Another is question relates to the militant nature of Orthodox Christianity. And the question is Orthodox Christianity implicitly militarist religion that is giving the space, giving the platform which can be used for such geopolitical projects?
I don't think that intrinsically Orthodox Christianity is more bellicose, more militaristic than any other form of Christianity. But as the Pope said, every religion has in itself the possibility, the temptation of basically becoming, let's say, fundamentalist and being open to the sacralization of violence. Obviously, the only question within Orthodoxy that makes Orthodoxy in this respect perhaps unique is the direction of autocephalous national churches, where then the together with the theology of symposium, the symposia theology between church and state, may lean to a very, very close link of church, state, and nation. And under certain conditions, it may lead to a kind of bellicose religious nationalism. We've seen it in Serbia. Obviously, you, Professor Metrebelli, are even in a better position to answer this question than I am, and perhaps other people in the forum here. But I wouldn't say that Orthodox Christianity is more than any other religion. We know that people talk like that about Islam, For centuries, Islam was a very peaceful religion. In the 1960s or throughout the 20th century, most of the violence came from revolutionary secular groups and not from jihadists. Things have changed, but it's nothing intrinsic in it. It's due to specific circumstances in which the temptation, which is always there, to sacralize either class, whether the ruling class or the underclass for revolutionary or for protecting civilization against communism, or race, it happened under Nazism, in which religion was sacralized, the Aryan race, or any nation. We see within the US, we see white Christian nationalism. We see, so there is this temptation within Israel, even Buddhism that was born as a pacifist religion. We see how it has been used in Burma or in Sri Lanka against other religions. So I think that has to do with unique combinations of circumstances of religious groups, political dynamics, state dynamics, and this is contingent. Yes, it can happen anytime, anywhere. I myself come from Spain. The Catholic Church in Spain was involved, of course, in crusades in the Middle Ages, and then we had several civil wars in Spain that were fought for God, king, and country, nation. And in this respect, yes, Catholicism also was used for violence in many, many places.
Thanks very much. There is another question, whether Putinism is a religion itself, but I'll ask first Mika Hagangas to present your question, please, and then I'll get back to the question about Putinism. So Mika, please.
Thank you. My question is, what will happen, according to you, Jose, regarding a symphonia between the church and the state, this Byzantian heritage that has been rather popular in the past?
I don't know. Obviously, there are theological reflections going on within Orthodoxy. And symphonia has been used in many different ways throughout. Again, it's a concept that can mean simply the need to have a harmonious relation between church and state. And also, this is what AUCRO, which is the All Council, All Ukrainian Council of Church and Religious Organizations, meets regularly with the state to develop harmonious relations when it comes to legislation. So there is nothing wrong with having a symphonic relation between religion and state to collaborate on all kinds of ethical public issues when it comes to legislation and so on, as long as one single religion doesn't try to monopolize the state, or the state monopolize one religion. And then, of course, you have the situation in which there is no possibility of religious freedom for minorities, or then becomes a religion that doesn't tolerate basically differences within. So this is a fundamental question. So the question is not symphonia, probably as a concept, a harmonious relation between public, what I call public religions and the state, is not public religions in the plural, and the state is not bad. The question is when it becomes a monopolistic relation that the state uses for political control, and vice versa, the church uses to maintain its monopoly and its hegemony over other religions. So.
Thank you, Mika, and thanks, Jose. Marietta, please.
Thank you very much for this fascinating presentation, Jose. My question really is about the nature of othering in the story of the Ruski Mir. And I ask this because it strikes me that there is a certain flexibility about this othering. The othering is always diametrical. It's always caught in terms of good and evil, but the object can differ slightly. It can be somebody is against the regime of Putin. It might be that somebody isn't quite Russian Orthodox. It might be that it's not the right kind of Russianness, not the right kind of Ukrainianness. But it doesn't seem to be a stable othering that is just about religion or just about ethnicity or just about race. And I wonder what your thoughts and reflections on that would be, on that sort of instability of this othering. Particularly, and that's the last thing I'll say about it, is because it means that this othering is volatile and is even more dangerous, right? Because we cannot really contain it, right?
Well, this is part of the problem with this war, is precisely because it's so ambiguous what the even the aims of the war are. Sometimes it's basically only to protect the people in Luhansk in Donetsk. The next time it says we need to denazify Ukraine and therefore to get rid of the government and establish a new government. The next one is whatever. There are two aspects of the Ruski Mir ideology. One is internal within the Ruski Mir, the formation of a Ruski Mir that comprises at the very center Belarus, Ukraine, and Russia. It's about reintegrating Ukraine into the Russian Empire. This, and so at any cost. The idea was at first, and this is why 2013-14 was so crucial, that when Ukraine asked to enter the European Union and it was passed by parliament and everybody had agreed on it, then there was a lot of pressure on the part of Putin and Yanukovych to renegade the agreement. A lot of money was offered to him personally, but also to Ukrainian economy, and he changed the position. And this is what led people in arms, that was treason to Ukraine, to what the people wanted and was Maidan. So this is one aspect of Ruski Mir, the internal, if you wish, war against Ukraine to reintegrate Ukraine. But the other is the war over Ukraine against the West. And here the West is not only NATO and the military alliance, but it's the decadent, liberal, secularist, feminist, gay West. And as Kirill said, this is a holy war because we are fighting so that there will be no gay pride parades in Luhansk and Donetsk. This is the kind of culture wars that the Moscow Patriarchate and Orthodox Russian oligarchs have been now organizing for at least 10 years in conjunction with the evangelical right in the United States and with conservative Catholics, especially through the World Council of Families. This is something which Christina Steckel and the post-secular conflicts have studied very well. Now, of course, many of the right-wing parties in Europe and against the European Union were precisely allied with Putin. Now this project is in disarray. We don't know what will happen to these right-wing parties. Obviously, none of them claim to be allied with Putin anymore. But this is another aspect of the conflict. So the other is, how do you other anything having to do with denazify, basically dekulakize, that basically means extermination. You get rid of the people. In order to kill the other, you have to dehumanize them. So you give them names that precisely say they are scams, they are drug addicts. Putin used the thing. The Ukrainian army is made up of Nazis, drug addicts, whatever. So you basically give them a name. First, you'd say that they have no name, they are not Ukrainians. And then you give them these other names that allows you to kill them. And this, unfortunately, is part of every war when you have to dehumanize the enemy. So othering here precisely changes what the other is, whether the enemy is all Ukrainians, only some Ukrainians, all the West, Ukrainians because they're allied with the West, and so on. So, yes.
Thank you very much, Oksana.
Sorry, thank you. I have a question, and actually two questions, if I can briefly. One, Professor Kazanova, you already began to answer about the position of other churches. I was wondering again, like from kind of theological maybe underpinnings, we can say, or ramifications of this war. How likely are more churches to recognize the OCU? Like, is there some connection between, opposition and condemnation of Moscow's invasion and the change in attitudes to the OCU that might lead other countries to recognize it? And my other question, just to follow up on something that you said during your original talk, that you expect a Moscow Patriarchy Church to remain in Ukraine, but in a smaller, perhaps, numerically and kind of. And I was just wondering, like, how do you see that sort of, what would it look like given that in Ukraine, there is great, including in the Russian speaking regions, obviously, where the Russian troops now have entered, there is great kind of unity, right, and resentment and hatred, of the Russian state, right, Russian leaders. And I wonder, would this be sort of communities where maybe the sentiment is not the strong? I guess I'm just trying to wrap my mind around, like, how would that in the society, right? Like, say, post-war society, right, where there is this church that did not severe ties, right? If, say, Moscow Patriarchy remains in canonical unity with Moscow, right? Like, how would they talk to their parishioners? So I guess these are my two questions. Okay. Thank you.
Well, I mean, to the first question, yes. I mean, we know that four churches, Greece and Alexandria, who is the fourth country that...
Romania.
Romania did already?
Yeah, I think so. No?
Did Romania recognize?
No, Cyprus.
Cyprus.
Yes.
So those were the ones, and there was a lot of pressure on the part of Russia, especially when the Greek church recognized, they said many of them who were not ready to vote voted because of the pressure on the part of Moscow. They were so upset the way they tried to blackmail them and threaten them. Yes, I assume that there were many more, but probably not in the midst of war. But I think that part of the isolation, especially for the European countries, today I heard that the Estonian, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church in Estonia, came with a very negative, with a critique of the war. So some of the, precisely also the Polish church, the Russian Orthodox Church in Poland has been one of the most pro-Russian. In the situation in Poland, I cannot imagine they maintaining this pro-Russian attitude. So this is likely to be, but we don't know exactly how it's going to happen. People say Bulgaria, Romania are probably some of the next ones. Obviously not Antioch. Antioch is completely in the hands of Moscow. Georgia is a complicated case because of the some division. Some people within Georgia want to, but others are very close to, because of the government, the insecurity. Armenia has its own dynamics. So I don't know exactly how it will happen, but I do anticipate that other churches will enter in communion with the, is there in communion with the patriarch? Of course, it was unilateral. The excommunication of the ecumenical patriarch of Moscow was unilateral. And so people that recognized the Oku Church didn't say, we simply break communion with Russia. We don't want to break communion with Russia. It's up to Russia to decide whether they want to break communion with us. So here has to do, of course, the symbolic notion of mentioning the head of the church in the liturgy. And at the beginning, Oku also went out of its way to actually mention also the Russian Orthodox Church. So there is this possibility. So we'll see what happens. And the other question, yes, it is difficult to imagine, but there are two things. One is, as you know, there were attempts to force the Ukrainian Orthodox Church to change its name to Russian Orthodox Church to indicate precisely they are not a Ukrainian church, but that they are really agents of Russia in Ukraine. And of course, this is the difficult thing having to do with finances. We know how much money has flown from Moscow to the Orthodox Church in Ukraine. That's why I mentioned all these buildings that are being built, not because they have a financial base in Ukraine itself. Many of those parishes are relatively poor, but a lot of money comes from Russia. So there are two issues. One issue is to, if you have a lot of communities in Ukraine, which are really made up of Ukrainians, they say, we want to maintain this communion, but we don't want to be called. So there is a way of doing it in which they, because after all, this is the churches in which their grandparents and great-grandparents worship, and they want to maintain this tradition. And a society that has freedom of religion has to allow Ukrainians that are, if you wish, lawful and loyal citizens to be, if you wish, in communion with whichever other religion group wants to have, so that they are not necessarily treasonous. We know that the Anglican Church in the US after independence had to change its name to Episcopal Church. They could not use the name Anglican Church. So obviously there has to be a change of name. There may be a change of structure so that they break the, if you wish, organizational relations with the Russian Orthodox Church, but somehow they want to maintain with the same kind of, maybe they want to do in Russian, the liturgy, whatever. So I'm not the person here to say. What I understand is it's going to be difficult, but also Ukraine should not proscribe and not allow people that want to maintain a religious identity which somehow is linked to 200-300 years history, that those people have no right to worship. After all, freedom of religion demands that precisely we allow individuals. It's different with organizations and transnational links, but Ukraine should not follow the road of Russia by prescribing anybody having links with, let's say, the outside world to be called foreign agents that had to register as foreign agents. I don't think that if those communities stay in Ukraine as loyal communities of the government in Ukraine, that they should be registered as, let's say, foreign agents of an external church. So I think that there should be, I think, a sensitive way of allowing people themselves to decide what is their religion, to which church they do want to belong. Now, organizations, as I said, this is different institutionally.
And to contribute to this, of course, Ukrainian system itself is very plural, religious market itself. And unlike Russia, there was decentralization. In my own research, I find out that even on the level of parishes had significant independence, were not relying so much on the bishops. So the central part is very distinct, and it's distinguished Ukraine from all other Orthodox churches that I studied or I've observed them, whether Serbian or Georgian.
It's a very, you could call it the populist church, a people's church, what the populace likes to call precisely the people of God, kind of also liberation theology. So it's very much a lay church from below, governed, self-governed from below, because precisely it was Russian Orthodox Church, but not linked to Imperial Russia in terms of the hierarchic monarchic structure then, or with the Soviet Union. So there is this part of tradition of a populist church that maintains its autonomy while belonging to the Russian Orthodox Church. Yes.
And the question which was mentioned before, whether Putinism is a religion, and is there a distinction between Nazism and Putinism in your idea?
Well, obviously, this is probably history will judge this question. Some comparisons can be made. Obviously, a friend of mine, Alex Motil, wrote recently an important piece in Foreign Affairs comparing, look what happened. You have when Brezhnev sent the tanks to Czechoslovakia in 68, they didn't enter to occupy, to kill civilians. Whenever in the past. So in a comparison in terms of the way in which this war is being carried out, the comparison is that of an extermination war, as it was done in Grozny, in Georgia, as it was done in Aleppo, in which you basically blanket out, completely destroy those cities, as it was done in World War II. We were hoping that this type of war will not anymore be part of Europe, but we are viewing it. Now, Putinism is not an ideology in the same way, because precisely it has no ideological center. Putin at first was simply, so it is on the one hand, it is linked to the ideology of the Soviet Union, but obviously because he is an old KGB, if you wish, agent. And yet, of course, he knows that, and he has admiration for Stalin, much more than for Lenin. But obviously, he cannot simply reestablish the Soviet Union. I couldn't say that he's a religious person himself and that he cares for Russian Orthodoxy or even for Imperial Russia, the monarchy. But certainly, he wants to be the Tsar of Russia for life. This is what he wants. He wants to be the Tsar of Russia, in a Russia that was extended as possible to what was Imperial Russia and the Soviet Union. But there is no ideology in the same way that behind the Nazi ideology, you really have an ideology of the conquest of the entire world based on the Aryan race, extermination of the Jews. So these other aspects don't make it into a totalitarian ideology. However, the more the war goes on and he views his own position threatened at home and abroad, there are more dangers that he will turn into a fanatic, if you wish, ruler that will basically do damage to his entire population. So more and more Russia will look like the Stalinist times. And given the nuclear arsenal of the Russian Federation, obviously the whole world must be worried about which kind of development, in which direction is Putinism going to go.
Thank you very much, Professor Casanova. It was wonderful, as always, to listen to your thoughts. And thanks very much to everybody who sent questions and the colleagues who've been here. For those of you who don't follow us, religionandpraxis.com is our conversation platform, which we use for podcast. And if you're interested, we have a lot of episodes on sociology of violence, religion, Orthodox Christianity, nationalism, you name it. So follow religionandpraxis.com. And thanks very much for today. This recording will be uploaded very, very soon, I think in a couple of days. And have a lovely and peaceful time.
Thank you.
Thank you.